I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and happy 2017 to you. Our guest this hour writes, in January, many of us resolved to develop better habits. And that's a good idea, because habits are the invisible architecture of our existence. We repeat, this is amazing, about 40% of our behavior almost daily. That's too much, isn't it? 40%. So if we change our habits, we change our lives. So there's no shortage of advice, but maybe there are some underlying concepts that we need to understand better before we're able to change our life. And who better to talk about this than Gretchen Rubin? Gretchen is the author of several books, including the blockbuster New York Times bestsellers Better Than Before, The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun. She has also just started, she started her career in law and was clerking for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor when she realized that she wanted to be a writer. She also announced today, actually, that she has a whole series of podcasts, which we'll be talking about during the course of the hour, so that you can, really think about making your life happier and much better, and what you can do in terms of very small changes to make a big difference in your life. I know this is a day, we just got a message from a friend of ours who was at the gym and couldn't find a place to park. That's what happens today. That's what happens because we all decide. And for a day or so, we're really taking charge. We'll be welcoming phone calls if there are things that you would like to do, and if you wouldn't mind having somebody who knows how to analyze how best to have you achieve your goals, give us a call. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Gretchen, Happy New Year. Hello.
Happy New Year. I'm very happy to be talking to you today.
You sound so happy. Do you feel compelled to be happy? Because you're talking about happiness. You really do sound happy.
Oh, well, no, I don't feel any pressure to feel happy. People often ask me that if it's sort of like a job requirement. But no, I do not always feel happy.
Yeah. You know what my saddest day of the year is every year? It's been without fail. It's New Year's Eve. Every single year, since I was a child, I get sad, I get morose. It's just awful.
Is it the idea that sort of time is moving forward and now 2016 is over forever?
Yeah, I think that's it. It's the people I've lost, during the years previous. It's not knowing what's going to happen. It's the anticipation of a great unknown. It's just, oh, brother, I'm okay today, but New Year's Eve, ugh. Yeah, I make a resolution to make that a little happier this year. Mm. I love the fact that you've really taken on this happiness thing, because it indicates to me that we really can make changes in our lives that may be substantial, and it doesn't take a huge amount of effort to do that. It just takes more getting to know who you are.
I think you put your finger right on it. It's really, the key thing is to know yourself and to really think about the kind of person you are, and what are those kind of small low hanging fruit in your life where you could maybe, without spending a lot of time or energy or money, make steps or make tweaks that would end up making you happier, healthier, more productive, more creative, whatever it is that you're looking for in your life.
Yeah. So tell me, what set you off on this journey? Because you've done all these books on this now, and the advice isn't trite. It's important kind of advice. But tell me, before we launch into all of what we want to do about ourselves, the Happiness Project and how you spend and why you decided that you wanted to spend a whole year of your life on happiness.
Well, it was a very inconspicuous moment of my life. I was finishing up my book that was a biography of JFK, and I was in a crosstown bus. I live in Manhattan, in the pouring rain, so we were going very slowly. And I thought, what do I want from life anyway? I want to be happy. But I realized I didn't spend any time thinking about whether I was happy or how I could be happier. So I decided I'm going to find out. And I ran to the library and got a gigantic stack of books about happiness, ancient philosophy, contemporary science, popular culture, and decided I would spend a year test driving all these ideas to see if I could actually make myself happier.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then for Happier at Home, I decided that I would spend a school year from September to May, really going deep, deep, deep into the subject of home, which is one of the few almost universal ideas. And then Better Than Before is all about habits, because what I realized is that for many people, when they're thinking about a happiness challenge, it's really because they have a problem with a habit. So they know they'd be happier if they exercised, if they got more sleep, or they put down their phone, or they worked on their novel. So why can't they?
Right.
It's how do they make that habit? So studying happiness got me into the subject of habits, because they're so closely related.
Mm-hmm. And I know you read a lot. I was interested in one of the books that you say that people should go out and get immediately. It's in conjunction, I think, with your podcast, which you launched. We heard about it today. And I haven't read this since I was in high school, but it made a huge impact on me back then, was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes. That is a book. If you want to start your 2017 off with like a great book, it is short, because I hate to minimize a book that is like sold millions of copies and it's a towering classic of world literature by saying it's short. But it's short. And it's incredibly moving and powerful, and it's transcendent, and it will remind you. There's so many passages in there that just. I can't get out of my head. So if you're looking for that book to kind of set the tone for your year, Man's Search for Meaning, I think the title makes it sound kind of abstract, but actually it's full of like really, really compelling stories of what happened to Viktor Frankl and what he learned from what he went through.
Yeah, it's a very important book.
Yes, it is.
So we need to understand ourselves. You say once we recognize the essential aspects of our habit nature, we can tailor habits to suit ourselves.
Yeah.
And you talk about these four types of habit natures. Most of us fit into one or the other?
Yeah. I think we all fit into one. I call these the four tendencies. And it has to do with how a person responds to an expectation. So it could be an outer expectation, like your doctor tells you to take your blood pressure medication, or you've got to meet a work deadline. Or it could be an inner expectation, like you want to start meditating every day. So there are upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And upholders are people who readily meet outer and inner expectations. So they make habits without much fuss. Then there are questioners. Questioners, they question everything. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So they make up their own mind whether they want to do this homework or follow this exercise regimen or do what their spouse asks them to do. And if they think it makes sense, they'll do it. If not, they won't. Then obligers, and this is the largest category, this is the one the most people fit into, they readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. Like a friend of mine who said, well, when I was in high school, I was on the track team, and I never missed track practice, so why can't I go running now? Well, when she had a team and a coach waiting for her, she had no trouble showing up, but when it was just her own expectation, it was a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, rebel. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They don't even want to tell themselves what to do. So they don't want to sign up for the 10 a.m. yoga class because maybe they're not going to feel like going. So they might sign up and then not go, or they probably wouldn't even sign up at all.
The
four tendencies.
So if you wanted to make a change, it would be important for you to identify where you fall into those four categories.
No, 100%. And most people can tell what they are just from a brief description, but there is an online quiz at happiercast.com/quiz if you want to like get an answer of what you are. But 100%, you're exactly right, because the things that work for one person don't work for somebody else. And we often make this mistake with habits. We think, well, it worked for Steve Jobs, or it worked for my brother-in-law, so it should work for me. But if you're an obliger, what you need is outer accountability. That is crucial. And that is why you can go to the gym if you have a trainer, or you've paid for a class, or a friend is waiting there to work out with you, or you're going running with your dog who's going to tear up the furniture if you don't go for a run. or you're thinking about your duty to be a role model for your children, to model good habits and sticking with commitments. So for an obliger, if they're trying to do something on their own, they often can't do it. They need to plug in that outer accountability. Now, rebels, on the other hand, that's actually counterproductive for them. They do better when they have lots of choice. So they don't sign up for an exercise class. They get the schedules for 5 different gyms in the city, and then if they feel like doing Pilates, they do Pilates. If they feel like doing cardio, they do cardio. Or maybe they feel like going running outside. they think about, what do I want? What kind of person am I? I'm going to do what I feel like right now.
Mm-hmm.
And questioners, it's all about, why am I doing this? Once they really make up their mind why they're going to do something, it's much easier for them to stick to it. But the problem happens is when a person of one tendency is trying to tell somebody of another tendency how to go about changing a habit. Because a lot of times we give each other the wrong advice, because we give each other the advice that would work for us instead of the advice for the person that we're talking to.
And as you say, there's no shortage of advice that people say, well, you need to do it first thing in the morning.
Yes.
You need to start small. You need to reward yourself.
Yes.
You need to make a list, blah,
yes.
blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah. And all of those works for some people some of the time, but they don't work for everybody all the time. And in addition to the four tendencies, you just pointed out a distinction that people so often ignore, which is morning people and night people.
Mm-hmm.
We often hear people, if something's important to you, you should get up early and do it first thing. That is terrible advice for night people.
Absolutely.
Because they are at their
get up early? Ugh.
Yeah, they can't do it. They're just setting themselves up for failure. And yet over and over, people are told, well, if it's important to you, you should be able to get up early and do it. No. That would work for one person, but not for another. So what I found is, when it comes to habits, it's not as hard to change habits as we sometimes suppose, but we have to do it in a way that's right for us. We have to tailor it for us, because people are very different from each other, and so we need to really figure out how to set things up to suit our own nature. Because when we set it up the wrong way, then a lot of times, you know, it's like the New Year's resolution that we've all made and abandoned and made again and then abandoned again, and then it's just very discouraging.
Yeah. So how about this? I've never heard this before, Gretchen. We repeat, you write, this is, seems like a terrible way to live, about we repeat 40% of our behavior almost every day?
That is what the research shows. But if you think about brushing your teeth, the way you get your cup of coffee, your commute, how you get dressed in the morning, like a lot of this stuff is on automatic. And really, habits are freeing and energizing, because they mean we don't have to use decision-making or self-control to go through these things. You don't have to battle with your will to get yourself to brush your teeth or buckle your seatbelt in the morning. You just do that. It's just your habit. So it's on autopilot. So in a lot of ways, this is really freeing for us.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of New Year's resolutions in the first place? Did they make any sense or not?
Well, I mean, I would say that all of us, for anything that's a catalyst for self-reflection, I think is a good idea, whether that's your birthday or it's the start of the school year or it's some kind of milestone event or it's New Year's Eve. All these things it's a time for self-reflection and to think about, well, what kind of positive changes could I make? But I will say, this is the way the four tendencies come up. Upholders who are like me, we love resolutions. We make them all the time. We love New Year's resolutions. Questioners don't like New Year's resolutions because they think January 1st is an arbitrary date. And they will often say to me, I would make a resolution, but I will not do it on January 1st because that is an arbitrary date. It doesn't make sense to wait. If I should do it, I should go ahead and do it now. That's what questioners say. Obligers often get discouraged because New Year's resolutions are often the kind of things that we're doing on our own. Obligers are great with like a work deadline, but when they're trying to start playing guitar on their own, they might struggle. So they get discouraged. What they need is that outer accountability. Then they're going to do a much better job of following through. Mm-hmm. Now, rebels usually won't make resolutions. Some rebels will because they think it's fun. They like the challenge. Most rebels will not bind themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like the idea of making a resolution like that. So I think for the right person, a resolution can be great, and I think it's a great thing to use as an opportunity for self-reflection. But the idea that we should all make New Year's resolutions, like most things, it works for some people, but not for others.
Not for others. And is it true, did you write this, that it's easier to do all of this if you have a really big thing going on? If you're taking a trip to someplace you've never been, you have to confront a new language, if you're falling madly in love with somebody, that all of a sudden this huge change in your life can lead you to be able to change habits easier?
Yeah, but what it is that it's going through the major transition is what it's not necessarily the upheaval. It's the idea that there's just some big change that has wiped away the old habits.
I see.
So if you're for example, when a study of people who had successfully made habit change, a very large percentage of those were associated with a physical move from one house to another. And when people are quitting smoking, they're often told, if you're moving, that is a great time to quit smoking. And it's easy to see why, because you know, you're going to a new job and everything's different. And so if you just start going to the gym as part of that new routine, it just quickly becomes automatic. Whereas if you're trying to do it at the old job, it feels like a big imposition that's being tacked on to your day. It feels like, oh, this is this whole extra thing. Whereas in the new job, it's just the way that it is. So any kind of transition, as you say, a relationship, school, job, location, even moving your furniture around. Somebody was able to give up stopping off for junk food when she got a new car. Because she was like, you know what? I got a new car. I'm not going to have junk food in this car. And then it was easy.
Right.
So she used that transition. I call this the strategy of the clean slate. The clean slate wipes away the old habits so the new habits can crowd in.
Well, if you want new habits to crowd into your life, give us a ring. Gretchen Rubin is our guest. She wrote a piece that appeared in The Guardian that caught our attention. Old Habits Die Hard. Here's how to change your life in 2017. She is the author of a number of books. The one that was on the New York Times bestseller list for number one, actually, for a long, long time, a couple of years, actually. The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, rather, and generally have more fun. Gretchen is our guest, and she has started a podcast as well. She dedicated a year of her life to the Happiness Project and found out what the sources are of happiness. And on this day, when we start thinking about how to change our lives for the better as we go into a new year, how can we do that to achieve more happiness in our lives? That's the subject. Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. To your phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Gretchen Rubin is our guest, author of Better Than Before, The Happiness Project, and Happier at Home, all bestsellers. And today she announced the launch of the Onward Project, which is podcasts to make your life better, happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative. And we start our calls with Betsy in River Falls. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. First of all, I would like to thank Gretchen for her amazing program and ideas, normally of which I would just go like, phew, but I'm just kind of impressed. But second, I want to respond to you, Kathleen, saying that you didn't like New Year's Eve. I used to hate New Year's Eve. I always felt like you started out in January and you climbed all the way up to December, and then the world came and smacked you down, and you had to start climbing all over again. And
right.
I was telling my mother this one time, and she said, no, Betsy, it's like a figure eight. It's like the eternity, the thing lying on its side that goes forever. There's no beginning and end. It just goes on a figure eight lying on its side. And from then on, I have loved New Year's Eve, and my life has gotten better. And I just wanted to share that with you, Kathleen, because you're one of my favorite guests. Hosts ever, and thank you.
Thank you, Betsy. Well, I have a new way of looking at that. I like the way you went. That's the way to look at it, right? Thank you, Betsy, very much. Let's go to Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, I just had a question. I was wondering if there are any suggestions on when we need to tackle, my husband and I need to tackle a real large project. We have house needs just a lot of maintenance, and we've both had some serious illnesses and haven't been able to tend to things, you know, how we'd like to. So we're just wondering how we kind of start looking at that fresh, and how to just keep motivated. And that's my question.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of different things that you could do. One is like just walking around and figuring out what you need to do. So having a very specific idea of what it is. And a lot of times things feel more overwhelming when you're like, oh my gosh, we got to get the whole house fixed up. But if you're just sort of, and maybe you want to do it like room by room, or maybe you want to set aside a half an hour each day to do it. Now, some people like to start really big. They like maybe like spend a whole weekend doing nothing but that. But a lot of people prefer to start small and keep it very, very manageable. If that sounds more appealing to you, then maybe it's an hour a day or it's a half an hour a day. And you begin just by making a list and getting a sense of what needs to be done. One of the things is that we often overestimate what we can do in a short time, but we underestimate what we can do if we work steadily over a period of weeks and months. So don't start getting freaked out if you don't get a lot done in the first hour, because when you start doing hour after hour, and maybe depending on how big it is and how much it is, maybe you want to do an hour in the morning and an hour in the afternoon, or if you can throw money at the problem, you know, if there's things where, while we could save ourselves a lot of time and energy if we hired somebody to do this, you always, if you have the money to do it, it's always helpful to think of, like, how could I bring in somebody from the outside who can do some kinds of jobs much more efficiently. And if you're, one of the things that you're trying to do is to declutter, it really helps if you know where things will go. It's much easier to let go of things if you can imagine where you're going to take them. Is there a thrift store? Is there a neighbor who's going to take your children's old stuff? Is there a school that wants all the old children's books? A lot of times there's a lot of kind of anxiety and uncertainty about letting go of stuff. And for most people, when you know that it's going to go on and live a good home, it's easier to get rid of things.
Mm-hmm. You have some advice for people who need to keep things in order every day, too. Obviously, Nancy has a big thing that has to be done. But in your book, you talk about, and I really like these. You know, they're simple things, but you've got what you call your fourth commandment, which is in January in your book. You don't postpone any task that could be done in less than 1 minute.
Yeah.
Now, that you can manage a minute, right?
Yeah, no, and that, it's funny. So many people say that that has really changed their lives.
I'll bet.
It's just the one-minute rule. Anything you can do in less than a minute. And what that does is it just gets rid of that kind of scum on the surface of life, those little things that are not big in themselves, but when you walk into a room and you see like a million little things that have to be done,
yeah,
it feels overwhelming.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so a minute a day. Also, you've got this evening tidy up rule, 10 minutes before bed to do simple tidying.
Yes, and this just, again, it's not a big commitment. You just work it into kind of the interstices of your day. I think it's a really great way to sort of prepare for sleep. It's a very kind of soothing, meditative thing, and it feels good to be putting things in order. It's a very kind of peaceful thing to do. And then, of course, when you wake up in the morning, everything is so much tidier. It's much more energizing because there's nothing like coming into a room and there's, like, dog toys everywhere. It's just like, oh, this looks like a mess. But when, and I find this with my office. If I really try to leave my office in the evening very tidy because it, then it's just much more inviting when I'm walking in the morning.
Mm-hmm. What about your dog, though? Is the room more inviting to your dog with the toys put all
away? Well, the minute they're all put away, he wants to go get them out again.
I'm
so
sure.
that is an issue. I think, yeah, but that's the fun of it for him. Dog toys are very easy to put away. That's what there's like a high. It's like putting the newspapers in recycling. It's very satisfying, or making a bed.
Yes.
This is one thing that many people point to as something that makes them happier. It sounds so simple, but so many people have told me that the simple habit of making their bed has made them feel healthier and more energetic. I don't know what the connection is between making your bed and just feeling happier, but give it a shot if you don't already make your bed.
It's a good thing to do. Let's go. Thank you, Nancy, very much for the call. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I had time to calculate it. It was almost 50 years ago. And the first thing I did is when I came back from Vietnam, was buy a Life magazine. And I read in there that President Johnson was developing a happiness index. I mean, here I was fighting a war, and the people back home are filling out happiness surveys.
Oh.
You know, the Great Society was in place, and he was going to find out if the society was much happier after that was being implemented. And is your guest part of that whole program of 50 years ago?
No.
From the government?
No, she's not. Gretchen?
No,
she's not that old.
I'm getting up in years, but I'm not old enough to have been recruited by President Johnson.
Yeah. And I'm sure that must be jarring to come back from fighting in Vietnam and have the president work on a happiness quotient. Certainly, he should have been thinking more about the happiness of people who were in Vietnam, perhaps, right? Yeah. Thank you, Kenneth, very much for your call. Sarah is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Happy New Year.
You too.
Gretchen, I've just so enjoyed your book, Better Than Before. It's really made an influence, especially the one-minute rule. It's ridiculous how simple that is. I mean, it's crazy. But my question for you is related to healthy habits and healthy eating. And specifically, you talk a little bit about sugar and being an abstainer from that in your book. But I'm wondering, like, how do you cross over from I want to make a healthy habit to not overdo it on sugar when it's just such a ridiculous temptation? And I don't want to use the word addiction, but, you know, just like a crazy temptation. And it seems like no matter how earnest I am in abstaining and trying to follow, you know, some of the strategy you have there, it's just a challenge. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm so glad to hear that my work has been useful to you. Yeah, and so you're talking about the strategy of abstaining, which is something that works very well for some people and not others, which is if there's a big temptation, for some people it's just easier to have none. Whether that's playing Candy Crush on your cell phone or eating sugar, it's just too hard to have a little bit for some people. It's easier to have none, and I am very much that way. I can have none of something, and I can have a lot of something, but I can't have a little of something.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say, I really don't eat sugar at all. And I feel like that is easier for me, way easier for me to be free from sugar than it would be if I was trying to have a little bit. And I know that sounds extreme, and it sounds like that you're kind of teetering at that place where maybe you want to be free from sugar and all the buzziness that comes with sugar, but then it also feels like a very big thing to just not have it.
Right, and that's where I feel like, oh, gosh, is this becoming a willpower thing, but I don't want, you know, there's a fine, well, actually, it's probably not too fine of a line between the willpower argument versus the habit thing and trying to lean way into habits rather than willpower because that just wears out.
Well, see, you put your finger exactly on it. That's why habits are easier, because if you're using your willpower, you're going to burn it out. It's going to tire you out. And maybe you resist sugar all day, and then you go home and you yell at your kids for half an hour. It's like once that we all want self-mastery, and everything mm-hmm. that we do that drags on that self-mastery drains us. So I love abstaining because there is no decision. Am I going to eat this chocolate chip cookie? No, because I don't eat sugar. It's my birthday. I'm going to have it? No, because I don't eat sugar. Oh, I baked these especially for you. No, I don't eat sugar. They're free. It's the store opening. It's the office birthday party. Do you eat it? No, I don't. Because as it turns out, I don't eat sugar. So that's just easier for me. Now, if that sounds too extreme, there is one way to have your cake and eat it too, literally, is a planned exception, which is, okay, it's Christmas. I love pumpkin pie. I'm going to my parents' house. My mother's making her famous pumpkin pie. I'm going to look forward to that. I'm planning to have it. I'm going to eat it and enjoy it. I'm going to look back on it with pleasure because I kept my promise to myself.
Mm-hmm.
That was my plan. I usually don't eat sugar. That day I'm going to eat sugar. Or my father has, like, the grandchild exception. He doesn't really eat sugar except that there's a grandchild around, and then it's, let's go to the ice cream store, you know? But only when there's a grandchild, so it's very limited. So
right. Yeah, and
this
that's
is about
the idea of,
keeping your promises to yourself.
Right, and those multiple strategies that you can work into. And I just want to mention, too, in enjoying your podcast with you and your sister, and she talks about kind of like the mind shift of not only am I going to embrace a new habit of not eating blank, but to position it in your mind as, or reframe it as, I'm free for that. I'm not losing something.
Yeah.
I'm gaining the freedom of, I think it was potato chips or french fries or
French
something.
French fries. No, she looked me in the eye and she said, now I'm free from French fries. And I was like, what? You know what I mean? I'm like, that's the way to think about it. You can be free from it. Because, you know, if people say to me, but doesn't it make you sad not to eat a brownie? I'm like, I am not eating brownies makes me feel so much freer and happier than eating any brownie ever did. Because it's just like all that tiresome noise in your head just goes away.
Yeah, great. Well,
I have more time to watch Game of Thrones.
Keep up the work, and looking forward to your, you said you have an upcoming book about your four tendencies, so that's going to be a joy, too, to come.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I so appreciate it.
Thanks,
that.
Sarah. Now, I have to ask you, because I'm the daughter of a sugar broker, and I can't think of a day in my life that I haven't thoroughly enjoyed sugar.
Oh, yeah?
You know, you took me to the IGA with the cotton candy machine when I was 8, and I'd make cotton candy cones for everybody, and when he died, I was cleaning out his refrigerator, and it was filled with Hershey bars. I'm not kidding you. The whole refrigerator was. So I haven't even thought ever in my life about giving up sugar, I'm afraid. But tell me why that's an attractive thing. Do you feel a lot better?
I do. And but the thing that makes the biggest difference for me is I was always trying to manage it, like having a little bit but not too much.
Right.
And that just was very tiring. Anyway, Gary Taubes has a book that just came out a couple days ago called The Case Against Sugar, which really lays out the very toxic effect of sugar on the body. And so if you're to anyone who's interested in understanding why the research seems to point to sugar as being kind of the factor among sort of obesity, diabetes, hypertension, blah, 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 all the kind of, all that, that family of stuff. It's a very fascinating book, not inaccessible for anyone who, and if you're a questioner, I really, and you're trying to do this, this research will help you stick to your habits because you will feel very strongly about sugar when you read the book.
Oh, that's interesting. But you see, I don't know if I can bring myself to read the book. Because,
I think it's, you don't want to give up sugar. So if
maybe
you don't want to give up sugar, then, you know, this is for people who really are like, I would be happier or I would be healthier if I could master this habit. So then that's important. But there are habits where some people want to make them and some people don't. Some people want to go to bed earlier and some people are like, I want to go to bed at 2 a.m. Like, fine, there's nothing wrong with that. Go to bed at 2 a.m. That works for you.
All right, here's what I want to do. So help me with this because I've said this for years. I've been doing interviews for I can't tell you how long, years and years and years and years. And I think about all the people I've talked to and all the books I've read. And do I ever write this down so I can remember everything? No. So that's my resolution, to write things, you know, what, because I learn new things every day, the nature of this job. I read a ton of books. So if I did it on the computer where I can type pretty fast, then I'd have a record of everything and I could go back, which would be so darn valuable, and I should have done it ages ago. But how do you recommend doing that? How can I stay with that? Because I know it would be important. What time of day should it be done? Do you look, you know, how should I do that?
So one good question to ask yourself is there a time when you succeeded in the past? So I will ask you, is there a time in the past when you did something and it kind of looks like this that was helpful, like when you were taking regular notes?
When my child was born, yeah.
Okay, and so what time, how was it structured at that point in your life?
Well, I never slept. You know how it is when you just don't sleep, so you have all day, you have almost 24 hours to write things down. But I don't know if there was a time of day when I did it, but I did do that for a while.
You did do that for a while?
Yeah.
Well, what appeals to you? What seems like, is it the end of the day? Is it the beginning of the day? Is it at lunchtime? Like, if you were going to sit down for 20 minutes and type, I do this myself all the time. I'm constantly taking notes in the computer.
Are you?
Yeah.
Good. Oh, good.
Yeah. But I'm an upholder, so things come very easily to me.
Right.
That's the thing, is being an upholder, like, doing that kind of thing regularly, just is very natural.
Yeah.
But if you feel like you want a little bit more structure, I would say the strategy of scheduling is actually put it on your schedule. For most people, if there's actually a time in the schedule when something happens, that's easier.
Okay.
So let's think, when would be the right time for this to be on your daily schedule?
Probably about 4 o'clock.
4 p.m.?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I would encourage you to go through in your calendar and literally put it in, note-taking. And it's like a dentist appointment or like an interview with a subject. Like, it's something that happens. If it can't be at 4, it has to be moved. It's not optional. It's on the calendar. It has to happen.
Okay.
And then the strategy of monitoring is keep track of how often you do it. So you might, like, in a calendar, or maybe on your phone or something, check off, I did it. Did I do my notes today? Yes.
Okay.
And I would keep it manageable. Like, how long do you think, like, 10 minutes, 15 minutes?
I think 10 minutes will be okay, except for some days.
10 minutes,
yeah,
okay.
When you're moved. Right.
So I would say, so from 4 to 4:10, or like 4 to 4:15, so you have a little bit that you're going to do this. And that sounds manageable. And now you say, except for some days. One thing that you might think about is, even on a day when you're really, really frantic, you might kind of symbolically keep the habit by even just doing one note, so that you're keeping that space open in your calendar. You're not thinking to yourself, well, if I need extra time, this is the thing that I'm going to throw off. This is the thing I'm going to not do because I need more time for other priorities. Because what's going to happen is all those other priorities will always come in and start crowding out this, because you're considering
sure.
sort of an optional thing.
Right.
So even on a day when you're like really frantic, try to make time to do at least 1 minute of note-taking to remind yourself, this is a part of my day that has to happen. I'm making a commitment to myself. And all your listeners are listening, so I encourage listeners to ask you, how's the note coming along?
No.
They're holding you to it.
You put me on the spot. I like this idea, though. Now you've given me a frame to do it. I like this. All right, I'm going to do it. I'm starting today.
Excellent.
4 o'clock. Good.
Let me know how it goes.
I will. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we're speaking with the author of The Happiness Project as we're talking about how we examine ourselves to find out how we can change our lives, which many of us think about doing at the beginning of a new year, to find out what will work for us. And so, you just heard mine. What's yours? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Sarah in Zion, Illinois is next. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Happy New Year.
You too, Sarah.
Thank you. You know, my question is about your guest. About your guest herself, because I'm just intrigued that I also heard you on the People's Pharmacy, and I think you're so interesting. And you seem like so open and flexible and easygoing with understanding how other people do things and how other people see things. And that seems a little bit unusual to me because some people just always see things from their own point of view. And I'm wondering, I can't remember what you said your personality type was in this context, and what is it about you that do you think made it easy, or was it easy for you to understand how different people do this?
Thanks for saying that I seem open and flexible, because I would think a lot of people around me would say that I seem kind of uptight. So I'm an upholder, which means that I'm in the tendency that readily meets outer and inner expectations. And as it turns out, that's a very small tendency. Very few people are upholders. And the way that I got insight into how other people are is as I started getting into happiness and habits and looking at the kind of things that work for me and the kind of things that work for other people, one thing that kept happening over and over as I was talking about the Happiness Project after that book came out is people would say to me, but how did you get yourself to do all those things? And I would say, well, I thought they would make me happier, so I did them. And then they'd be like, yeah, but how did you get yourself to do them? And I was thinking, what are they getting at? Because I don't understand really what they're talking about. And I started to think, like, well, some people are different from me. How are they different from me? And this is really strangely overlooked in a lot of discussions of happiness and good habits and just human nature generally, is how often people are just different from each other. In a lot of ways, we're very much the same, but the differences are very important. And so even like we were talking about abstainer moderator or morning people, night people, or, you know, some people are simplicity lovers, and they like bare surfaces and clean shelves and not much going on and not much noise. And then some people are abundance lovers, and they love profusion and abundance and choice and buzz. And you get, like, a boss who says, well, you know, a cluttered desk is a cluttered mind, because that's what works for him.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's true for everyone. And somebody else, you walk into their office, and it's a giant mess, and they're like, oh, well, this is how I stay creative, because that's what works for her. And it's not that one person's right and one person's wrong. But what I found is that the more I could understand how people were different from me, how they had totally came to things completely differently, then the more we could just talk about things dispassionately and figure out how to get to a place where everyone can thrive. But the problem is a lot of times you just assume, you don't even understand that you have a perspective. You're just like, well, this is the way everybody is. Everybody does better when they're fresh in the morning. No, that's not true. A lot of people aren't at their best when they're first thing in the morning. And so the more I studied it, the more I started to see how different things work for different people. And there isn't a right or a wrong. It's just what's right or wrong for me or for you.
Thanks, Sarah, so much for your call. Greg in Waukesha. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Gretchen. Gretchen, I have your book on audiobook. I'm going to have to read The Happiness Project, and I'm sure some of your other books are available in audiobook as well. My comment is I find that I thrive best when I have structure in my life, when I have things that I need to do. For instance, when I was in school, I did a lot better with my time management and everything else. Right now I'm a freelance writer, and so I find that I don't have that structure, and so I'm not thriving, you know, as well. And I was wondering what advice you would have for someone like me who feels like they need structure but not necessarily, you know, because of my profession and the several odd jobs that I do, what advice would you have for someone like me?
Well, I think that the first thing and the most important thing is something that you've already done, which is that you've recognized a pattern in your behavior, which is I do better when I have structure, I do better when I have accountability than I do when I have when those structures are not in place. And so the question is, given your situation now, how can you create the kinds of structures that allows you to do well? And you've also identified a time in the past when you succeeded. So when I was at school, that's when I succeeded. So you might think about, well, was it the feeling of getting a grade? Was it the feeling that my professor cares about me? Or is it just the feeling like my professor is checking up on me? And as a freelancer, you have some deadlines, but it might be that it would be better if you could create more accountability. So whether that's by forming an accountability group with other people who also need more structure and need more accountability, or working with like a coach who's, you know, a coach is somebody who can give deadlines and hold you accountable and keep things moving forward. And also, you can't, like the schedule, just literally, you have control over your day, but sometimes that freedom can feel overwhelming. You might do better if you really like scheduled it in. Sometimes funny things work. I have heard of many people, writers, who will like get dressed in a suit, say, or will do things like do an artificial commute, like walking around the block twice to be like, now is the end of my personal day, and now is the beginning of my professional day.
Oh, that's interesting.
Going outside, I have a little commute. Now I'm home. I had a friend who was an artist who lived in a studio, and he didn't allow himself to sit on his bed because he's like, I'm at work now. I can't sit on my bed. I know what will happen. I will take a nap. So I can't go near the bed. So there's a lot of things like that to help structure the time to feel more like this is work and these are the things that need to be done during that time.
Gretchen, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thanks, Greg. Happy New Year to you. Joanne is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Happy New Year, Joanne. I'm good. How are you?
Happy New Year. I'm great.
Good.
Two things. One, I want to tell Gretchen that when I was reporting, I had to learn how people thought differently because to do stories with them, I had to think the way they thought. So that was always a challenge for me.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I'm going to break out of the rut that I've been in for the last 3-4 years, Kathleen, and I'm going to get a puppy.
Oh, you're going to get a puppy. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
How exciting. That's the best news I've had all day. Mm-hmm. No, that's great, Joanne.
Well, I've been thinking about it for about a year and a half, and I know it's going to change my life, so let's do it.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Do you have him or her picked out?
No, not yet.
Okay.
I may ask you to come puppy shopping with me.
Oh, Joanne, consider it a given. I'm with you. I'm there. I'll go with you. I would love to. Just give me a call. Seriously.
What did your guests think about that strategy?
Well, you know, the research shows that people who have dogs or pets are happier because it's a relationship, and relationships make us happier. Plus, it leads to new and challenging adventures, and that makes people happier. We just got a dog a year ago, and it definitely made us happier, too. So that's a great – and you're going to have all new habits. So if there's some big thing that you want to try, maybe do it at the time that you get your puppy.
Mm.
Okay.
Oh, Joanne, good for you. You're going to be so happy about it. I really think you will be. Just make sure you put the toys away at the end of the day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joanne. I'll look forward to hearing from you. Ah, puppy. Nothing like a puppy. I think everybody should have a dog, though. I know everybody shouldn't have a dog, but I love dogs. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about our New Year's plans to make ourselves happier and how you need to analyze yourself to find out how to do that. Our guest has written about happiness extensively and dedicated a year to her happiness project. She is the author of Better Than Before, The Happiness Project, Happier at Home, all bestsellers. And today she has launched a podcast which is titled The Onward Project to make your life better, happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative. As we tend to think about these things early in the year, if you have an idea of how you can make yourself happier and how to have it become a reality, we would love to hear from you. Lines are open. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we're welcoming your phone calls as we help you, our guest actually helps you, Gretchen Rubin, how to find more happiness in your life. Tell me a little more before we go back to phone calls, Gretchen, about the podcast which you launched today. It sounds really interesting.
Well, I have a podcast that's been going for more than a year called Happier with Gretchen Rubin, which is a podcast that I do with my sister, who's a TV writer in Los Angeles, and we talk about happiness and good habits and human nature. She calls me her happiness bully. So that's called Happier with Gretchen Rubin. But just today, a lot of people were saying to me, well, Gretchen, I really love Happier, but I want to listen to more podcasts like yours, but like, what would you recommend? And I didn't really have a lot of podcasts to recommend that were similar in vibe. And so the Onward Project is a family of podcasts that are all going to be sort of in this kind of a similar, if you like this, you like that. One is Side Hustle School, and one is called Radical Candor. And so those two podcasts are just launching, and now we're sort of in a family. But my own podcast is called Happier, and that's been around for a while.
Mm-hmm. It must be fun to do podcasts like that. It's a good idea.
Yeah, well, and it's really fun for me to do it with my sister because she's brilliant. And somebody was just quoting her, saying that she was now free from French fries, and you know, like we've been called the click and clack of podcasters because it's sort of, you know, it's two sisters. We don't let each other get away with much.
I'm sure you don't. What about other books? We started the hour talking about Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning. Are there other things that we should have in our happiness library?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many fantastic books about happiness. You know, it's something that people have been writing about for thousands of years. It's sort of like it depends on what genre you're like. At the end of all of my books, I always have a lot of selected reading because I'm a huge reader myself. And so I kind of like love so much. My mind is going blank, I have to say. it's too broad a field.
Right.
Yeah. Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. I mean, I just saw Hamilton recently. So,
oh, you did?
Yeah. So Benjamin Franklin, if you are a person who's interested in self-improvement, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin is like that is perhaps the quintessential account of. And you know, we should all be as productive as Benjamin Franklin. You know, he's inventing bifocals and starting a library system while being a founding father. It's amazing. So
it is amazing. He was an amazing guy.
He was an extraordinary.
He should have been
guy.
Nicer to his wife, though. He was not nice to his wife.
Well, that doesn't come up in the autobiography, so you don't have to think about that part.
Oh, that's good. Let's go to Bo in Eagle River. Hi, Bo.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello, Gretchen. Happy New Year. Thanks for taking the call. Real quick, I grew up in northern Minnesota, where schools do not close if it's 40 degrees below zero. And there's a book out there, Minnesota Happy. And Gretchen, we are happy people. There's something about when I talk to people from Minnesota, my friends, relatives, but just strangers, there is this delightful sense of humor that kicks in all of us that get us through the darkest times through our, journeys in life. So are you aware of that book, and why is it that Minnesota people are happy?
I have not read that book. It's interesting. Many parts of this, I think, of the country and certainly of the world will say that they're they're happy, which is great. And there's actually a lot of research trying to pinpoint why certain countries or certain areas are happier than others. And one of the things that turns out to be really important is community spirit. How much do people trust each other? How much do people feel like they can trust strangers? How engaged are people in their communities? So it might be that in Minnesota, it's just like got a good neighborly vibe, and that makes people feel happier. And sometimes one of the things that draws people together is something like really, really bad, harsh weather where you just have to deal with it and laugh about it, and you're all in it together. So that's terrific. I'll look for that book.
Thank you so much for the call, Bo. And thank you so much for being with us. It was a really fun and I think very valuable hour for all of us. A good way to start 2017, Gretchen. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on. It was so fun to talk to you.
Gretchen Rubin, she has a podcast now. She's the author of The Happiness Project, and she's the author of several other books as well. And the podcast may be a place for you to go, or to one of her earlier books. The article that recently caught our attention was found in The Guardian. And I thank Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. I hope your year is very happy and meaningful. And we'll be with you again tomorrow on the third day of 2017. Thank you very much for listening.